trying to fight with the people as you're building it up and try to encourage them, look, you know, I'm building it together, you know, better get with the program or else we're not going to be able to throw it away together, and people would be totally disregarding and ignoring them. And it seemed, and I'm using the word seemed, because it seemed as if he said, well, okay, then I'll just save my own family. And then years later, when Abraham came into the picture, he was also trying to fight with the people to try to follow Hashem's ways and to better themselves. And he really put himself much more into it than Noah did. He didn't give up. He didn't say, well, okay, there was no ark at the time, there was no nothing, but there was Sodom and Gomorrah to the point where people, all the people died there, but it wasn't the end of the world, even though Lot and his daughters did think it was the end of the world, not Lot and his daughters, but the people just decided that they were going to live their own life, and Abraham did continue to try to save the people and encourage them that they shouldn't disregard. Rabbi Mann's article he said very briefly, if you put yourself in a situation when you don't have the strength to fight the people, you'll go down with them. Abraham, in his own way, even though he came from a totally different background, Noah was a rabbi, Abraham wasn't, and Abraham was a convert, he had more strength in him at the time to say, there is a God, and you have to follow the God, and if you don't listen, you're going to pay the price. And so he was the one who seemed to be the one to save the people more so than Noah. But the main point that Rabbi Mann had written in his article was that if you don't have the strength to try to fight your battle and to try to save the people, you can't save the world unless you really have the strength to save yourself, and then you can save the world. The whole thing comes down to the idea of the life preserver. It's about thinking, and it's one life preserver. Who do you give it to? You give it to yourself. And you get yourself to catch your breath, and you strengthen yourself. And at that point, you now have the energy to reach out to somebody else, and to someone else, and to someone else. But until that point, you're at the same point as the other. You're drowning fast. So I think that was what it was about. At least this is what I got from it.
Yeah, that's right. That's what he wrote.
Yeah. So I think that's a very, very big point for all of us in every form of life that we go through each day. We don't have the strength. We have to get our strength back and make it strong enough so that we can hold ourselves up. If we hold ourselves up, then we can reach out and just lift someone as well.
Yep, that's correct.
Thank you very much.
Noah was saving the world, and Abraham was saving just two cities.
Well, it said in the article, in the article, it said that you could save the world. By saving yourself, you could save the world.
Well, it doesn't matter how many people you're saving. The point was that Abraham was not affected by the negative society around him, regardless of how many people he was involved in. And it seemed to be that there was a difference. But I think still study has to be made so we see it ourselves. So you have to maybe look up the Gemaras. You have to look up the Gemaras and see what the Gemaras say.
I really would like to know how one could say that Abraham had so much more strength.
Well, you have to study the Gemaras. I think it's the first thing, is to look up the resources on this and see what the rabbis say about this.
Yeah, it's a very important point.
Yeah.
Everybody's life really hinges on that. Okay, thank you.
here, the Torah is recording stories about personalities, so there must be a tremendous amount to be studied about each one. So that has to be the first step, is to look at as many sources as possible and see what the rabbis are really getting at. Because a lot of what we have in the Torah is, the commentators of, like, Rashi and so on. So they were basing a lot of what they wrote on what they had, other material. So we should get our hands on that material and see if there's more to the picture than just saying that, you have to strengthen yourself before you strengthen others, which is true. I just tend to think that if there's a whole section of the Torah dedicated to Abraham, many sections, and then to Noah, so there must be much, many profound ideas that are really trying to be conveyed. So the first thing is to really look up the sources.
Yeah, somehow I'm thinking that the Rambam has a really good amount on that topic. I have a feeling that he writes about that too.
All right, take a look. If you find out where he writes it, let me know.
Yeah, because I'm thinking in regard to the perplex. This is a perplexing issue. And I'm just wondering if it might be a little. I'm going to try and go through that today.
Yeah, take a look. See if there's anything.
I'll
find something.
I will later on. Thank you. Okay. I
think
I'll get back to that.
Okay, so I guess we should start. We're in Kehelas Zion, chapter 7, and we touched upon a new turn in the verses last week. And I can't say that have answers this week for you. I mean, certainly, if King Solomon is saying that the knowledge that he was trying to get was, far from him and very, very deep, and according to one explanation, he didn't attain the knowledge he was seeking. So certainly, how can we? I mean, there's certain areas that are beyond the scope of even the wisest men. I mean, you're talking about God's knowledge. So there has to be a tremendous amount that is just, impenetrable. There's a certain amount that we can get, of course, as well. I mean, that's evidence in the fact that King Solomon did write, a tremendous amount. But he says here in 7:22, this is all this I have tried with wisdom. I've used wisdom to try to penetrate the knowledge. And I said it, I've become wise. But in the end, he says, but it was distant from me. It was far from me. So he's telling us that the wisdom he was trying to attain was very, very distant. And then he says in 24, that was in 23, excuse me. And in 24, 7:24, he says that very distant is that which was already in the past. We talked about that to try to go back to the beginning of time was his intent, because he felt that if he could look at the beginning of how things were created, so the formative process when God created the world, if he could understand how that took place, that would unveil greater knowledge to him. Meaning he'd be able to see the specifics. We gave examples of a chair and so on. So when you see a complete object, it's hard to extrapolate as to what went into it to bring it to this point. You could make deductions. But if you see it in its creation, then you know for sure how it was made and all the elements that were included. So you have a greater knowledge at the formation. So that's what King Solomon was saying, that he tells you the result. He says, very far off, that which is, in the past. It's very, very deep. Who's going to find it out? So we deduce, why did he go back into the past? So for this very reason. But he realized that this was something which was he couldn't penetrate either. So in 25, he says, I returned then myself and my heart, two things, to know and to explore and to request, to seek out knowledge and wisdom, understanding, and calculations. So now he's going to explore whatever he can, what's in front of him. Or we'll see, it is a very interesting sworn on this little read to you now. And to understand Resha, the wickedness, and Kessel, foolishness, or Resha Kessel, the wickedness of the fool, the sichlus and foolishness, and halelus, idiocy. He wants to understand all the different functionings of the mind. He wants to understand a human being. So why is he looking to a human being? Why is that the object of his exploration? So we didn't say it. We didn't have this question last week. But of course, to understand what the best thing is in life for man, which is what this book is all about, so you have to understand man. You have to understand how man works. If you're going to make a statement that something is good for man, so first you must explain what man is, and then you could say why a certain phenomena or a certain activity or a certain object would complement man's nature and give him the happiness he seeks, and how would it work. But you see, what he looks into in terms of man are attitudes, values. A person who's wicked or foolish or if he's just removed from wisdom completely. I mean, he didn't leave any stone unturned. He wanted to explore and see all these different elements. So let's take a look at Sforno. Sforno says as follows. So he says, one second. We talked about one thing that he said, that the ability for the person to form knowledge about the essence of something is difficult. Because the real truth is God's knowledge. So our ability is human. So there's a great discrepancy between what man can attain, because whatever we form in our ideas are all tied to the physical world. And the truth is something which is absolute and is God's knowledge. So that's one very big hurdle. He says it's a very big distance, man's knowledge from the actual truth of something, which is the intelligence of the Creator. And he says it's very distant. It's far off that which I can really, which I can approach. I mean, in terms of what type of ideas can a person form in his mind, in terms of what happened at creation. So Sforno agrees with what we were saying, that he went back to explore what was, but what was is not just a year or a millennia ago, but at the time of creation. So you see, we were on track when we were saying that King Solomon went to look at the formation of things. That's when he felt that he'd be able to see greater knowledge, and that makes sense, as we explained. But he says it's very, very deep. The matter of creation is very, very deep, according to Sforno. For this is the working of the Creator. Without man, I mean, we mentioned this commentary last week. What I mean is the working of God without man. Well, of course, man wasn't there. I think Doug was the one who said that. The fact that this was God working, it was Him working in terms of the great wisdom involved. And this was something which was not on display for man, so it wasn't something filtered down to an intelligible type of an expression of what God was doing. So since it was a tremendous feat, and it was God creating the act of all acts to create something, a universe from nothingness. So this was without man at that point in time. Man was not there to witness it. And man was the actions were done prior to. I think we also said it's prior to how we work, because our knowledge can only penetrate from the point of creation and forward. But not prior to that, because there's no since we are, our thinking works in a cause and effect fashion, so we could only explore a universe that is physical with this cause and effect functioning. But we can't know anything prior. We can't know what went into the creation of something from nothing, because that's prior to the actual creation of the thing. So when Sforno says that man was not yet around, there's another point he's saying, is that maybe this is even the primary point, is that this is something which King Solomon realized man's knowledge can't explore. And scientists today all agree, from the point of creation and backwards in time, it's impossible to think into. And this is something which the Talmud says in the Talmud Chagiga, and I think we may have mentioned it last week too, that if a person thinks about four things, it's better off if he's not created. And what are the four things? He says, what came before the earth and what's going to come after the earth. Meaning, in certain epochs where the ability for man's mind to penetrate is just not there because it's not functioning in a way that man can think into. It's like trying to think inside of guessing what's inside of a black box. You can't. There's no senses that a human being has that he has any way to guess or to come to any real true conclusion as to what's in a black box. The senses cannot penetrate it. There's no sound. There's no visual. So you have no idea. So that black box is just like, it's a parable to what happened prior to creation. Okay. Now let's do a new Sforno. So he says as follows. He says, now they realize that it's too far off, that studying creation is something which is too far off, and it's too deep. So there's two elements. That's why we said it's amok, amok. The pasuk, the verse in 24 says it is deep, deep. Why does he say it twice? Because it's referring to two elements of it. It's far off in time, and also in terms of the subject matter is very far off. Sometimes you can have subject matter that's right in front of you, but if it's too deep for you, so that's one type of depth that you can't penetrate. Just there's so much prerequisite, you know, knowledge that you need. So if you don't have that, there's no way to start thinking. You can't start thinking about astrophysics before you even learn about physics. So there are prerequisites in the sciences. So that could be, that's one area. But let's say you're trying to understand the physics that took place 5,000 years ago. Even after the world was created, but what was going on over there? So since there's a time element that's very far off, so that reduces greatly the amount of evidence that you have to use. So that's the second reason why he says it's very deep. There's two reasons why the knowledge is deep. So at the end of that verse, King Solomon decides, well, what, I'm not going to give up. Interesting. He doesn't say that since it's very far off that it's off to any exploration at all. No. He realizes he has a mind. So he explores, but what does he now explore? It says that he explores as follows. He says, I turned and I returned back and now myself and my heart. What does it mean I returned back myself and my heart? So he says myself refers to from being engaged in, I tried to remove myself from the physical considerations. And or it could mean, you see, a typical person is involved in physical pursuits, and that's all that occupies his time. But you can't say that about King Solomon. So what does it mean that I returned myself, that I returned myself and my heart? So Sforno says he returned in order to pursue his studies, so he decided what new approach could he take, that I would remove myself from the physical, the study of the corporeal world, which was what the studying of creation was. And he says, and also my heart, and I'll give myself the opportunity from all other investigations. And now he's going to, what is he going to investigate? Now he's going to investigate how man works. So he says, I'm going to explore with the delving into with great analysis, and I'm going to look into the works, the writings of the earlier generations, and I'm going to look for wisdom. What type of wisdom? He says, the intent of God with his creation of the universe. What is the intent? And he's going to explore calculations. What type of calculations? So he says an interesting thing. He says, I'm going to look into the reason for the set number of existences and species. Because they are created in a manner that if man wants to add on to the species, any species at all, and create a new one by crossbreeding, that new breed that he creates, like a horse and a donkey that creates a mule, he says, lo yasmid, it will not remain. In the fashion that any new type of species he makes will not be able to produce. And that's a fact. Any crossbred species does not produce.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Is this still Sephora reading all of this into verse 24?
Yes, amazing.
It strikes me that he's going way beyond what you could reasonably take out of the text.
Yeah, well, the thing is that does strike you. Actually, this is 25. I'm sorry. In 25, you see, he says that I turned myself and my heart to know, to explore, to seek out wisdom, calculations, knowledge. He's got so many words in here. So Sforno's saying these things refer to certain specific things in creation. He wants to understand the nature of existence. And he says that going back in time, exploring creation, he can't do. So now he's going to explore what exists. But there are categories of what exists. And there's ways to explore. He could look into what the intent is with God, and how do I see that? He looks at all the creations and the number of creations. I mean, that's what calculations, meaning number. Calculation has to do with numbers. So number of what? So at the top of the scale, you're going to see the number of things created in categories of species, living things, non-living things, things that have will, things that procreate. So there are main categories that he's now going to explore and then see if he can now derive from this an understanding, the intent of God in terms of making all these species. Why is there a set number? He was not giving himself a small task. But Sforno's saying that you have so many words that he said he was doing here, that he enumerated in this, you know, verse 25.
And I see now that, okay, so he's taking like every individual clause and saying, okay, what does this mean? And so just in terms of methodology, when we get to the one, you know, the reason of things, which he says is counting the number of living things, do we have any idea how he gets from the words in the verse to that particular interpretation? Because the reason of things, you know, I mean, that's so broad that you could interpret it a lot of different ways, and he obviously has a specific interpretation. I'm just wondering how he gets from the words in the verse to that particular interpretation.
Yeah, I can't explain why. It could be based on a number of things, his broad knowledge, the use of the word in many other cases. Or it could be, as we said, that, you know, he tried to look at creation and it was far off. So to witness it at that moment, that he can't do. So what else is there? So the only thing left to explore is actually what was created that's in front of us. So based on that, you could use that as the backdrop as to what the next step is when he says in 25, well, now I'll return my heart and myself and my heart to seek out. So what is he seeking out? It can only be what's in existence now. And then, of course, the smart thing is to look at things in terms of head categories. So, you know, very Aristotelian in terms of, you know, very logical approach.
Okay.
And then, of course, he explores, you know, the human being. At the end of this verse, he says that, I'll read to you, this also will be an amazing thing. I mean, where he gets this from, but I'll read it to you now. He says also that I'm going to look into understanding the evilness of the fool. What is he referring to? Of the snake in Genesis. How was it that it was so cunning. The verse says it was cunning from all the other animals, but it wasn't afraid of punishment. How could it be that these two conflicting type of attitudes, being that the snake was it spoke, so there was intelligence, so whatever it was a real thing, as Rabbi Chait explained, a real being. Now, if it was so cunning, why was it that this cunning characteristic did not educate the snake about a very simple thing, about the eating the fruit was against God's will? Why was he not afraid of punishment? So that's what it means is that King Solomon says, I'm going to, once I explore all the different phenomena that God created, now I'm going to look into attitudes of intelligent beings. But I want to understand, how does it work that a person could do so, if not a person or a being, can commit evil when at the same time it's called a cunning being? That's not one. Then he says, he also wants to understand what sichlus is. Sichlus means like foolishness. So he says, who is he referring to? The foolishness of Eve. She was enticed by the desire to eat this fruit, and she wasn't afraid of the punishment that she even mentioned to the snake herself. The snake and her were discussing, and the snake said, can you not eat from all the fruits? So Eve says, no, all the fruits we can have, it's just the one that we can't eat. So she was able to actually verbalize, she knows what the punishment was, so how could it be that she was enticed? So this is another thing that King Solomon is saying that he was trying to study. And then holelus, which means like idiocy or complete abandon. And he says this refers to Adam, that he was enticed by the words of the snake also. And he turned to be heretical. He went against God. And he was also enticed to eat from the fruit at the request of his wife, with the fact that the punishment would be death. And Chaim is writing on screen, it's better to forego the deep and lofty realms of knowledge and concentrate on the wisdom of the living. I'm not sure what you're referring to, Chaim, if you want to lose a day. Okay. But you see what he...
I don't agree with that.
Well, I'm going to let him write. I don't know what he means yet, so let him write so I can see what he's saying. I don't understand what he's saying, actually.
Because the wisdom that's coming from the sages... You're carrying up for
you. Well, let's see what he writes to explain. I don't know what he means yet.
Okay.
Thanks. Okay, so, but you see what King Solomon's doing. He's still going back to Genesis. So the principle seems to be carrying through that still, if you want to understand something the best as possible, so you look at its inception. You look at it at the beginning. So he's talking about, look at the beginning, what took place in terms of these beings that had the different faculties of the mind, and how does it work? You have to know, basically, how is it? I don't think he means these specifically, but he wants to understand there are main categories of human emotion and the psychodynamics and thought, and how can it be the existence of wisdom at the same time that you have these other emotions? How does it work that you can go against what you know is to be a threat of death if you eat from this fruit, but then you can just be enticed? How does it work? So he wanted to understand the real elements, the forces, and the dynamics of a human being, if you want to sum up what he just said. Meaning, how can you see, how can it be that a cunning snake cannot be afraid of punishment? And how could it be that the woman, that she was able to even enunciate the fact that there was a punishment, yet she gave in? How does this work? At what point does there shift? At one point in time, she was abstaining from the fruit. Another point in time, she's giving in, she's eating it. So how did it work that there was a change made? That is a very good question. How does it work? Is it merely that people who want to describe it's a certain amount of energy goes into it, and before you know it, you're just giving in? But how does it work that you just give in? How does it work that you, at one point in time, you were allegiant to the command, at another point in time, you finally succumb? How did that change take place? that the person now is able to make a decision in favor of that which previously he stayed away from. He feared something earlier, but now he's not fearing it anymore. How'd that change? So he saw that there has to be something explained in the human mind, in the psyche, that the person can now, certain, maybe there's a step or 10 steps, who knows? But there definitely is a question. What produces this? And certainly if something is very cunning, how is it not afraid of something which is true and absolute? So yes, today we you know, and King Solomon had the answer too. You know, you have other faculties called justification and rationalization. And there's a way that the person starts to explore if he wants something enough. So he starts, he has to feel there's a good. That's one thing for sure. Like Rabbi Chaya explained years ago, that there's something called the reality principle. And a person will never do something that he feels is really harmful. If he ever does something which seems harmful, he must have justified how it's really a good, either momentarily, or this will be the last time I'll do it. Whatever the excuse he gives, the person has to feel that he's doing the right thing for himself right now. But if a person cannot come up with any justification, any reason that he himself, as that specific person, with all of his, you know, emotional makeup and his past, if he cannot give himself a reason to do something, he will not be able to do it. Because a person must do, at any moment in his existence, he must do only that which he feels is a good for him. That's just the way we're built. We can't function otherwise. Even suicide. A person who kills himself is convinced this is better than living. Yes, Francesca.
So are we saying then that the sin in the garden is the first example of the emotion covering up the intellect, because the snake's argument wasn't an intellectual argument?
Yes, it seems to be. We don't know that it had the same exact design as the human, but you see that Eve and Adam, they both sinned, so, but still, Sforno is looking at the snake as being something within the same arena of creatures as you know, man and woman. Although it says open that God only gave an intellect to Adam and Eve. He didn't give it to the snake. But there was something about the snake that had speech. But at least it had cunning. You see, it had cunning. He doesn't say it had intellect. Sforno doesn't say that the snake had intellect, and therefore, why was the snake able to sin? He said even the cunning faculty, which is a psychological thing, according to Sforno. Because again, God says openly they only gave the tselem elokim, the intellect, he only gave the man and woman. But nonetheless, he still feels that since God does say in the Torah that snake was more cunning than all the other beasts, so that means it had a faculty that was sharper in terms of its motivations, in terms of maybe its perceptions, in terms of its calculations. Even though there was no intellect, there was something. It still had speech. It was an amazing type of a creature. But yes, I mean, this is he's going back to this point, if I understand your question, that this, he wants to understand the initial cases where there was a examples of how the mind and the psyche worked, and he wants to see if he can unravel truths based on the first cases found in the Torah.
I have a question.
Yeah.
I thought that the overpowering of emotion came after they ate the fruit and not before.
Well, how did they eat the fruit if they didn't have an overpowering of emotion?
I thought that they operated according to truth and falsehood first, and then after they ate the fruit, then they were clouded by emotion.
No, they still had emotions beforehand, because you see that it says, even before, what they were given afterwards, if you take a look at Maimonides, the second chapter in the Guide to the Perplexed, he explains that what they didn't have before the sin was knowledge of good and bad, meaning morals, morality. Is this good for me? Is this bad for me? That's why they were naked and there was no type of a judgment about that, of being, they were embarrassed, it says. man and woman were naked, and they were not embarrassed because there was no such thing as morality yet. And that was a good, because the higher level of knowledge is about true and false. What exists, what is true about creation, and what is false. That's how you understand God's wisdom. When you examine the world and you see what is real and what's not, true and false. Bad and good is not a knowledge of what is in the world. It's of, is this something which is better for me? It's a question about this, the person. And the reason why God gave that after the sin, as Reverend Shade explained, it was like giving man a secondary brake system before he sinned, because he saw how fast, right away, the rabbis talk about that on the first day when man was made, that was the sixth day of creation, and on that day is when he sinned, and he was driven out of the garden. It all took place in that day. To show you that, although that was the preferred state, that man only have the knowledge of what's true and what's false, and to be involved in that would be the highest state. Nonetheless, the desires, he still had desires. That's why it says that the woman, she saw that it was a desirous to eat the fruit, and that there were still emotions. There still were emotions there. So she went right forward. So the emotions without the morality would drive man to just keep on sinning and then eventually just kill himself. Do whatever he wants. So God made a change in order to put a slowdown. So next, after they sinned, and now they were embarrassed, and they saw that they were naked, all this now shows you that now they had a sense of good and bad. The next time they want to sin, now they're going to have something called guilt, which can hopefully stop them from sinning so quickly. So that was the intent, that God now created this new apparatus of the mind called morality. Now they would feel, well, is this good or is this bad for me to do? Maybe I shouldn't do this. They didn't have that before. They didn't have that before. So clearly just a command with the emotions and intelligence, but no morality, there was nothing to hold back. Once the desire was aroused, that's it. They went right for it, nothing holding them back. So this is all brought down in Genesis to educate us as to what the necessity was for God to create the morality. Now, had God created the morality at the outset, man could have a good question. Well, God, why did you do this? We see this as something that's really, it deters us from being involved in the real appreciation of science, which is purely a study of true and false. Understanding the molecular world, understanding zoology, all these different things, that doesn't require morality. So to be involved in really appreciating the higher levels, man could say, well, God, why did you create man with morality? It's taking us away. So God shows you, you see, you do need it. Because here was a case where I created man without morality, and he disobeyed. And he couldn't follow the command. Even one command of the Creator, he couldn't follow. So it answers a question before it's asked.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Rabbi, isn't it true that people basically are not stable in their thoughts? When they make a decision, they now get new information, and they can reevaluate and then come to a different decision. And this can keep going back and forth countless times. So I'm thinking that if we make a decision, we're not really thinking about the final decision. And we can make the changes. And I think that Rabbi Chay had said that we ultimately will not do anything that will harm us unless we truly believe and rationalize that no, this is not harmful, there's a good reason to do it this way, and so on and so forth. It's so complicated, I really don't know how to come to a conclusion on that.
A person won't go on forever debating. The person will come to a point where he realizes, or if he doesn't have the knowledge, he investigates. That's what the intelligent person does. He investigates something until he has the best knowledge. If he's not forced to make a decision at this moment, so he could put it off until he does come to a clear conviction in his mind. But a person typically is not, you know, oscillating. He's not just, you know, on the fence all the time. People have to make decisions in life, so just practical day-to-day, people make decisions. And usually decisions you make each day are not things that, you know, make or break you. So if I made a mistake, I see it, and I'll correct it tomorrow, whatever. But typically, you know, if a person's trying to live rationally, he'll investigate it or he'll ask it for advice and makes a decision.
But isn't it true that if a person makes a decision, comes to a sound decision, and then a new person enters his life, comes in with another thought, and now the whole thing starts all over again?
No, it doesn't. That's not typically how I see it.
It happened, right?
It's not typical.
It's not typical.
No, a person has to make a decision about...
So it's very unstable.
No, it's not. I mean... That could just be a person's own fears or a person's own doubts, but then they have to realize that.
Mm-hmm.
You can't just, you know, a person could always be doubting things, but that's an emotion. Then a person's got to work on themselves and realize that they have this problem and to overcome that.
Right.
It's not because of the...
I think that fear is a big factor in something that occurs like that.
You know, that's what a person has to get... A person has to get
over on the fear itself. Can make the person just immobile and so forth, making a final decision, staying with it, no matter how many people enter his life with new suggestions. There's something in the person, the fear, and I think that what they take so that if he finally comes to the conclusion that there is no fear, there is nothing that's going to hurt the person.
There's two points here. One point, Rabbi Chaim was just saying, is that a person will always do something that he feels is good. He'll justify it. That's one point. That's not just your point. Sounds like another point. Well, can a person always be in doubt? Yes, but that's something a person has to overcome. They have to get rid of their fears, and that's a personal thing. It's not because, you know, it's there are a infinite number of possibilities in any given decision. That's not true. That's, you know, you have to go on a person-by-person basis and look at each. Sometimes it's a personality. Sometimes it's a personality that they're always like, you know, like they have a phrase called a doubting Thomas. So there's something which is motivating a person to do that. I mean, a person has to see a wise person who knows psychology and try to uncover what is it that is causing that. But that's a different point than Rabbi Chait's point. Rabbi Chait's point was that what we're discussing over here is that a person will always have to do something which is good for themselves. So that's what King Solomon was trying to understand. How does a person get to the point where they have the cunning and they can also, you know, how do these things work? So he was exploring Genesis again. Just to go back to the original point, he was exploring Genesis. But again, he felt that's really where he could see great insights. So again, what he was doing in his verse 25 was looking at what exists and the best that he can, even though he can't go back to the moments of creation, but he gets definitely look at what people have written, and he could use intelligence and he can investigate, but then he also has to look at, you know, human workings. And that's by exploring the world and the thinkings of man, now he'll be able to get to, he's on the right track to understanding, you know, happiness for man. All right?
Yes. Yes, that definitely makes sense. Thank you. Yes.
Okay, so like I said, I didn't really have answers. I just wanted to explore further, but maybe what we'll do is think into this. If you can get a hold of this Sforno, or if you want to listen, you know, I'll make sure that the class is online, so you can listen over again to the Sforno, that part. And let's, I think we'll stop here, because I didn't have, again, it was something I really didn't make, you know, big inroads into, so I can't offer any answers, but at least we got some understanding as to what he's doing here based on Sforno. So maybe we'll stop here unless there's any questions or comments.
I think we're good.
Okay, so look over. That's the Sforno on 25. Doug, do you know offhand that they have the English Sworno for Koheles?
I don't know if it's published separately, but Judaica Press has Lamentations and Ecclesiastes in a single volume with commentary, and they have a compendium of commentators, and on this particular verse they happen to go into the Sforno in the detail that you described.
Wow. Is that in English?
Yes, it is in English.
And is that something which is maybe you can copy and paste and send it out to the list? Is it like in an editable, a digital format?
No, it's not. I'm not sure if it's in digital. I'm not sitting here with a hard copy.
Oh.
Although a number of the Judaica Press books are online, and this one might be one.
Okay.
All
right, you don't have to do it right now, but if you have a moment, you can see if there's a, if it is, maybe share a link or the text if you find it. I'll try to look for it as well. See if it would be good to have the English in front of us, since there is a lot of detail there, and I'd like to see that myself.
Okay, so if it is not, then I guess I have a copyright question. Since they have a copyright on their book, is a person allowed to take a copy of a page and share that with other people?
Yeah, it's just one page. I wouldn't worry about that at all. It's not the... Again, it's Sforno, so that, I don't see how they can own Sforno. I think we discussed it once before. Sforno wrote his ideas of Torah because he wanted it to be shared. So if somebody translated it, you're doing it, and the truth is also the principle in the Torah that a person desires that mitzvahs are performed with his property. So even the translator of Sforno into English, so certainly we can go by that principle and allow him to benefit us by us benefiting from his English translation. And we're not even, we're not minimizing the sales of his book. We're looking only at one commentary, too.
So okay.
I wouldn't worry about it.
Thank you.
And the truth is also, do you own the book?
I do.
Okay, so Rabbi Mann once said, once you have something that you own, CD, book, whatever it is, you could make copies and distribute it because you're not doing it for commerce. So he said openly, he addressed this once.
Okay, thank you.
All right, so what we'll do is we'll look this over and we'll resume next week on this, all right?
Okay.
All right, thanks very much. Okay. Have a great week.
Okay, thanks everybody. Have a good week, everybody.
Have a great week, yes. Yeah.